This is Luke Fritsch, friend of Nicholas and Kent. I'm a fifth generation farmer and a high school math teacher, and this is the Prairie Farm Podcast.
I'm Doug Duren, a landowner trying to be a conservationist.
I'm Tabitha Panis, president of the Iowa Prairie Network.
I'm Ryan Callahan, director of conservation at Meat Eater.
Angela from Axe and Root Homestead.
Chris Helzer, the Nebraska director of science for the Nature Conservancy.
Judd McCullum from Working Class Bowhunter.
Taylor Keene, founder of Sacred Seed.
Ryan Bryson with Bryson Wildlife.
This is Luke Fritsch.
This is James Holtz.
Joy Van Weingarten.
Sam Sobel.
Phil Ebert.
Julie Meechan.
And you are listening to the Prairie Farm.
The Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm Podcast.
Prairie Farm Podcast. Welcome to the Prairie Farm Podcast.
Fritsch, good to have you back. Can you enlighten Nicholas and our listeners on the great Fritsch chicken massacre, or as they'd say in the old Davy Crockett movies, massacre of 2023?
Definitely. So I forget what year now. We probably have had chickens, just layers, for 3 years. So we have not been butchering them for meat, although the raccoons had alternative plans for that. And so they've just been laying eggs. We actually bought them at a local farm store. And as chicks, raised the first group in our barn. They did really well, started laying. We got some more. They were doing fine. And then at one point, we knew two different people that wanted to get rid of their older chickens. So we took on a group of 8 and then a group of 19 within a couple weeks' time.
What? Where were you storing? Had you like built a facility for them?
So the barn that they're in, since we've talked about some of this before, as far as the infrastructure of where I live, the barn was probably built in the late 1800s. It was modified in the 1950s, but the room that they were in is part of the original structure. So there's sandstone and brick footings underneath this room. And I mean, it's probably a 20 by 30 foot room. And we had some chain link fence panels in there and then nesting boxes. And we put all these chickens in this chain link pen inside of this room.
Mm-hmm.
So they had space. Initially we were letting them free range as well. And then we started losing chickens and we thought, well, these chickens that we took on from these other people, since they weren't raised here and they were more in captivity, we probably should not be free ranging them this soon until they get acclimated to the farm. So we started keeping them inside and we kept losing chickens. We thought, this is weird. And then the one day my wife called me and said, there's a dead chicken just laying next to the ladder for the loft. I said, oh, okay.
Oh, the raccoon sucked its blood.
Yeah, that's a chupacabra. What it looked like.
Ugh.
You know what chupacabra is, Nick?
No.
What?
No.
Nick's like, is that like a something off the...
You sounds know, like a disease.
Value menu at Taco Bell?
It's like, oh, don't go close to Ken. He's got chupacabra.
It's a vampire goat, right? Isn't that what
I
it
think
is?
So.
Like, oh, it's like a demon goat.
Yes.
Gross.
It's in the same family of organisms as Sasquatch and a few others.
Man, I think I've seen one now that, yeah, I know what one is. I've seen one.
With the way these raccoons behaved, it could be in the same, what is that, genus?
Yeah, be in the same genus as raccoons.
As a raccoon. So, yeah, the insides were eaten out of this, like probably the heart. I didn't do a complete anatomy check on it.
Necropsy.
I didn't have Kent there at the time. So, later on that night, I got home and there's a hayloft above this room. And I thought, I'm going to go up there and see what's going on because that's where this chicken fell from. And there's feathers and carcasses everywhere.
Ugh.
And this probably.
So you don't go in the hayloft very often?
No, I had no reason to go up there recently at that point. So I had not been up there, and yeah, go up there and it's just littered with feathers and carcasses.
Ugh.
So
how'd you keep the raccoons from getting them after that?
Well, okay. We ended up putting a top on the pen so the raccoons couldn't get down in, and they just trashed the barn that night.
Like, oh, trying to get in.
They were I had covered up every nook and cranny that I could, and it was pretty secure at that point. And they never did get any more. And I started live trapping them that summer. Kent actually came out and we did some investigating, and he had a hypothesis of their origin. They were actually probably coming from a quarter mile, maybe 3/8 of a mile away from a timber. And that's, I ended up catching them on a path that they were taken in.
That's crazy. That's some pretty good tracking. That's some Davy Crockett stuff. Hey,
Fritch and I spent a lot of time walking around looking at the ground for interesting things.
Yes. So that was the end of the massacre.
The massacre.
Yes. But they ended up killing, I bet, 15 chickens.
Wow.
And
you ever think of like how horrific that is for the surviving chickens to like be sitting there in that pen, like listening to their pen mate just getting munched on, like 15 feet above their head.
you know, chicken, so self-aware. So.
I mean, like, maybe if I just sit here, they'll take the one next to me.
Yeah. Right? It's like the turkeys. It's like everyone for themselves. Yeah. I didn't like that lady over there anyway.
It's a good story to kick off the podcast for multiple reasons. One, because it's just an interesting tale. But two, it's a realistic part of when you choose to intentionally include aspects of your own food procurement on your own yard. Like that's one of the hurdles to doing that. It's not, and we recently talked with Chase Burns a little bit about how with homesteading, it can have this kind of glamorous appeal on social media, like, oh, just get chickens and it'll make life easier and better. And it does achieve both those things to a degree, but there's still hurdles that, we have to be aware of. And
I would argue that it doesn't make life easier. It just makes it better. You know, I think that's the reason people don't have chickens anymore is because it is harder.
That's a fair point as well. I think in some ways, though, it probably does make life a little easier as far as, hey, we're out of eggs. Oh, man, I got to go drive it. You know, for Fritch, it's a 25-minute drive to the grocery store to go get more eggs instead of a 25-yard walk out to the...
Yeah, but Fritch is a calculus teacher. I feel like if we quantified this whole thing, it's harder. Ain't no way you're going to tell me that our life is harder.
You definitely make a fair point, though, Nicholas. You definitely do.
It's almost 8 o'clock p.m., I'm feisty, and we're going to fight. I'm going to fight Kent tonight.
That's fine. You'll lose. But especially if it comes down to making bets. I'm on a five-bet win streak.
The wonderful lady Kathy at Zip-In nearby, where we'll go and get lunch sometimes.
Cafeteria, basically.
Dude, we'll go there, and at this point, Kathy knows, like, Nicholas, you probably lost a bet. She probably thinks like I'm some stupid idiot that like can't guess anything correctly.
That has nothing to do with your betting record.
Yeah. Totally separate matter. That is the case, but it's totally unrelated.
No, it's a great story. I mean, even when it comes down to like the problem solving, to Nick's point, it takes effort. But I think that's good. Like, how much more engaged are you? And what parts of your brain and your body that you're engaging in order to make this happen. I mean, it takes physical effort, it takes mental effort, it takes emotional effort, I guess, fortitude to stick with it and to not just say, well, that was a failed experiment.
Definitely.
Which is really kind of the thing that, so go back and listen to our first interview with Fritch. We're hoping to do this every year going forward. A big part of why Fritch does what he does and why I moved over to the career path that I'm on is because we want to include those efforts into our life because we saw what life was without those efforts being a part of it. And we could look back and see the evidence on our own yards of those in our family that came before us, how their efforts are still standing and still noticeable and really serve as a rebuke to what the quote unquote perfect life should look like, or normal life even should look like in the 21st century, right?
Definitely. And along those lines, you talk about previous generations. The chickens are actually back in the original chicken house now, that raccoons cannot get into. So my dad and my wife Amanda and I restored a chicken house that was actually built from parts from the first house that was on that land.
Wow.
So some of the timber in it was probably from trees that could have been from the late 1700s.
Yeah, that's just insane. That's wild.
So if you go in there and look at the studs, there's all these lath lines. And as Kent knows too well from working on his own house, and I don't know, in your real estate projects, if you've ran across the...
Any plaster and lath?
Oh, yeah, dude.
So it's weird because you go into a chicken house, you don't expect to see residue from the plaster.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see all... I was looking at all these parallel streaks of plaster there. I'm like, why was there lath in here? And I was like, oh, because this is the second time this board has been used.
Yeah.
So
that right there speaks volumes too.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't happen anymore because one, it's so cheap to get new wood, but two, new wood is cheap. It's low quality. Like, you know, you deal with pine and it's just like you couldn't reuse it if you wanted to.
Yeah, think of the grain count on those old boards compared
four
to
four growth rings versus the 30 that
right
2x4 that's on there.
You know, something that made me think of on our farm is my great grandfather's, which may have been his dad's, old anvil, and it's on a, like you said, it's on a stump. I'm guessing it's walnut, just because the history of timber on that farm has never included oak.
Okay.
And I don't know that. So there's been a lot of elm on that farm, which oddly enough, I found out, I can't remember if I told you this, 1 year grandpa and his brother, Reuben, my uncle Reuben, they cut down a couple of elm trees and built the, corn crib at my uncle Reuben's that's still standing today out of elm. How many buildings do you hear being made out of elm?
That is wild.
But this anvil sits on this stump that's, you know, probably about diameter of well, maybe not my waist, but Nicholas's waist. but
34, but, in case anyone wants to know.
A trim 46. But you think, like Fritch is saying, you think of the age on that stump, you know, and it's probably not cottonwood. It's probably not, you know, it's probably walnut. So slow growth cycle, you know, that's got to be dipping back there into, you know, pre-American Revolution almost.
Yeah, because it's if it's been sitting there for 100 years and it was cut 100 years ago, it's not like the tree it was cut from was 0 years
right,
old.
Right, exactly.
That point.
Yeah. It was probably already 100 years old at least. So it is those types of things, you know, we're throwing in these random little stories like that to help kind of set the scene for how we view the you know, everyone's got a worldview, and there's been the metaphor used that a worldview is like looking through a set of glasses that have a different color filter on them. Fritch's and my color filter is like that.
Is patina. Is before glasses were invented.
Black and white. Yes. Black and white. Patina.
Yes.
But we like to look at the historical significance of things and try and draw connections to that and see what can we learn from that, that what is still useful. And taking that forward to Hoxie, and you look at the equipment we use at Hoxie, a lot of that stuff is a lot of that stuff. I think the newest thing, the newest equipment we use are the cedars that Carol designed.
Yeah, I mean, some of those are brand
maybe
new.
Maybe our side cut mower or something like that.
We have a 2016 or 2017 Vermeer baler. That's okay. Pretty new.
Yeah.
We've got a skid steer from 2014 something. But that, I mean, it looks old because we just beat the heck out of that thing.
Yeah, but, I mean, but for the large part, we use old equipment because that stuff still has purpose. And I think it serves as a... Again, another, I think a good word for it is a rebuke to how things are done now, as does Fritch's chicken coop.
Let me put in some perspective about Kent and probably Luke as well. Luke or Lucas? I always call you Luke.
But Luke's good.
Okay.
Either
well,
one's fine.
Fritch is safest.
Fritch, yeah. Riffing with Fritchin'. So if we went to the NFL Hall of Fame, or some incredible museum with wildly good art in it, Kent would say, man, this place is amazing. You know, elk used to walk right here where we're standing. That's exactly what Kent would say. We'd be in the middle of a city with some of the greatest art mankind has ever made. Dude, I wonder the acorns that are under this cement right now.
Guilty.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's important to look at things that way to some extent. Obviously, you know, every person brings their own strengths and their own pitfalls. And I suppose a pitfall that Fritch and I could bring is we could be a speed bump to progress at times. But we also define progress differently, right? Probably in the sarcastic way that Aldo Leopold refers to it as. He would say it in the terms of like that forest fell prey to the axe of progress or something like
yes.
that. Axe of progress. But no, we got a bunch of talking points tonight. Again, go back and listen to that first episode to get an idea, a picture of Fritch's family farm. Fritch does farm still with his dad and brothers. He also works as a high school math teacher. I asked Fritch for a list of topics that he would like to cover in this, and it's awesome. It's really good stuff. So
let's give a little context on. So yes, Fritch is a friend, but we have a bunch of friends we don't randomly ask to come on podcasts unless they're either an expert or have a very interesting take. But the thing about Fritch is he's very thoughtful. So he's interesting and he's thoughtful, and he's not trying to like sell anything. So we're not just having him on here as a favor so he can sell something. But the point is, he thinks about things very differently, and he thinks about things for long periods of time. You know, he really puts thought and he chews on things, and that's the reason he's here. So when we said, cause usually we come up with an outline, we're like, Fritch, what do you want to talk about? You know, like give us a list. He sent back a list pretty quickly of, some pretty pointed core values or anti-core values, and I was shocked. But that's part of the reason for anyone who's like, why are we, you know, some random math teacher that, you know.
I appreciate that. You should tell my high school students that I'm interesting. But yeah, one of the benefits to this.
What does that mean?
And to the creating that list is it's nice because. As we progress through a year and you read certain things or observe certain things, and as you guys know, we've had our group messenger deal going, and a lot of times I'm Kent is throwing stuff at me or I'm sending him these messages to get his thoughts. So it's nice because we have this pretty much a 365-day collection of... Maybe we don't want to say grievances, but of things that have come up and you think, well, this really fits in the scope of how this started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're well read like all the time. I mean, you've heard it on Coffee Time. Fritch sends us articles all the time and we don't bring it up every time that he sends an article.
Right,
so
yeah, a lot of good content.
Yeah. He's well read. You're not going to go into a conversation with Fritch with your feelings about stuff. And unless he's feeling generous, you're going to leave knowing some real stuff.
And I think that's one of the things. So a good friend teaches you things, right? And one of the most valuable lessons Fritch has taught me is to have very few sacred cows. There are some things that, yes, like we hold on to this no matter what. I agree. But most things, I think Fritch would agree with me on this. Most things should not be treated that way, because that truly can be a speed bump to progress.
Yes.
And so because of that, he has a, I often, well, back when I was teaching, we would go to meetings together or something, and, or there'd be some new policy rolled out, usually not from within the school district, usually from a higher power at the state level or the federal level, that would just be like the most bananas thing you ever heard. And I would say, Fritch, I wish we could have the view of an alien sitting in their UFO looking down on Earth and listening to this conversation right now and just be like, wait, what are we doing about what? And Fritch is good at that. He comes close to that alien view of taking the step back and being like, let's look at what we're doing. And does it make any sense? And should it continue? And what changes should we make? So that's what we're going to do. We're going to take that alien in the UFO hovering over the board meeting room, or what would be another, like a stakeholders meeting or whatever.
Yes.
Other kind of gatherings that take place in organizations of every kind and stripe that shape how we do things as a society in 2024. And so the first thing we're going to talk about is living in rural America. where we're at here, Nicholas was commenting as we were driving down the road today in this part of the state of Illinois. We're in West Central Illinois. And he was just commenting on the structure of the towns. Like, how would you describe it again, Nick? I'm not going to put words in your mouth here. When you were talking about the little towns we were driving through and the houses there, and
I was talking about, so the shapes of the houses and the thoughtfulness and how they were made. My town, and I love my town. My town doesn't have that in their houses. I mean, you're talking about like towns of 600 people with, you know, 110 houses if they're like big, and they're really cool. They're old. And they were made well. It's obvious they were made well, and they were shaped well. And even just from the way that they're shaped, you can tell like, oh, a lot of thought was put into that house. It's probably very well built. So I was saying there's a lot more potential in those houses for the future than there are in houses. Like so many of our houses in our town and my town need to get torn down. But here it's like, I bet those were made with old 2x4s that were made out of, you know, walnut.
Yeah, some are oak or old growth pine or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear you say that, because, you know, growing up here, it's like you kind of don't think about it maybe. But this would have been historically, obviously, agriculture number one, but also coal mining, right, mm-hmm. Fridge?
Yeah, and I was thinking as Nicholas was talking about the condition of the homes and how well they were built, because I also drive the bus and yep. I'll sub routes here and there, and I often get frustrated because you're driving 15 miles in one direction to get rid of a student, and you get to their
house. Get rid of a student, he says,
and you get
just
there,
inside the mind of a teacher,
and you realize the only reason I just drove 15 miles in this direction was because at one point there was coal right here.
Yeah.
And there was a house that was built in the early 1900s, and somebody inhabited it.
Yeah.
And they had a child. So now we're responsible for delivering that child out here. Should they actually live in rural Sherrard School District? I don't know. I don't know if they're, and this is part of what we've discussed before as well. Are they using their surroundings to their benefits? Is there a reason for them to live there? or is it purely just where they watch TV at night?
You know what I'm hearing you yeah. say is not that it's that they're living there because that's where they can live. There's no intentionality behind it. They didn't pick that spot to do a specific lifestyle. They're like, well, this was the house I inherited, or this is what I could afford, so this is where I'm living.
Or sometimes it's just as much of a whim, you know. I want to be out in the country.
Yeah. Oh, this house is only $80,000. I wonder why that is, you know. I could watch TV in this cheaper than any place else.
Yeah.
See, I think he stated it well. Is it contributing to a way of life? Or is there some other reason that they're there? Or is, as Kent just mentioned, the idea of living in the country and driving further to work?
Well, so people that just watch TV at night, where should they live?
In my opinion, in the most efficient place possible.
A city?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I am not a sympathizer of like, well, you know, that's just what they can afford, because my wife and I had no money and we bought a house. So, you know, people can move and buy houses, but
yeah, I think it's an interesting point and certainly a fair point. And I don't think the answer is just that, and I don't think Fritch is insinuating this either, that nobody should live out in the country. But if you're going to, you should consider why it is that you're there and how can being there have some sort of utility factor and also have some kind of meaning other than just I like it here.
Yes.
And it was built for a purpose, an efficient purpose. Hey, we got to wake up in the morning and go into that coal mine. Or hey, we got to live out here because this is where we have cow pastures and, you know, crop fields and you know, space to put up a barnyard.
Yeah, taking care of the surrounding ground.
Right, right. So how do it's a very fair point. How do we then help people, like, come to terms with that?
Well, I don't know if I'll answer your question specifically, so you may have to modify it as we go.
Okay.
But, and I think we might have talked about this the last time around, where we envision rural America as the media and the government wants us to, where we have these small farms and they're 80 to 160 acres or whatever they might be. And we're living in these farmsteads and taking care of the ground. And we have cows and chickens and raccoons, whatever else. But we have this diversity surrounding us. And the eggs that you buy at the grocery store are these locally grown, if you live in a rural area.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we want. It seems like that the desire is that that's how you picture.
Right. Norman Rockwell, rural America.
Yes. And when you start to really break down what's happening in rural America, that's very far from the truth, is that people are actually using rural America as it was used initially and as it's used in those narratives. And maybe that's all I'll say about that for now. So you can modify what you were saying or.
Yeah. Essentially what we're saying is the purpose for having the house near where there was coal is gone because the coal mine's gone.
Yeah.
The house is left standing, but we're still living in that house because for something. Right. And we're projecting on it an ideal of the past that is no longer currently what's happening. And so essentially what's happened is industry has left rural America, right?
Definitely. And I think as we were talking before the podcast started with Nicholas, you guys have a little bit of a different perspective. Obviously Kent grew up here, but you live closer to industry and where you're at in Iowa mm-hmm. than what we have here, where we went from coal mining communities and agriculture and a farmer every 80 acres, a farmer every 160 acres to towns that were inhabiting factory workers, because we used to have IH.
Mm-hmm.
We still have deer in the Quad Cities, and I forget what it was, but we've lost tens of thousands of jobs over the years. But since people had grown up in those towns, they were okay with treating them as bedroom communities.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And that's what was feeding our school district that I work in as well. And at the same time, a lot of those factory workers were either displaced from families that had grown up with coal mines, or they were from baby boomer generations where one kid was left farming out of multiple, and those other children had to go find a place to work. So if they stayed local, they ended up in whatever the metro area was and mm-hmm. hopefully had a decent living from that.
Hmm.
So the farms got bigger and the coal mines closed. Well, now we're sitting in a place where some of these farming entities are taking care of multiple square miles of ground.
Mm-hmm.
The farmsteads have been carved out from the landscape and people are just living there. And that's kind of what our topic has been here.
Hmm.
Separated from the land.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you from the school district perspective, we sit here and talk about like, well, what's going to happen to our enrollment? Because at Sherrard, where I teach, by the time my fourth grader is in high school, we will have probably decreased in enrollment by 20 to 25%.
Wow.
And people are upset by that. And but then you got to look at it from the common sense approach. Like, why would we still have people here?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no job. And something that's interesting is it's not that all the industry has been stolen from the land. The industry's there. It's just you need way less people for that. I mean, the factories aren't there.
Yes.
That's a big thing. But the coal mines and the farm ground, all that industry, it's actually probably making more economic value.
Not the coal mines anymore.
No.
But also, I mean, it would be interesting if you adjusted for inflation, and of course, you know, we're going to hear that yields have gone up, and they probably have. I mean, we plant corn on narrower rows now than we did back then, but we, you know, have fine tuned fertilizer and of course, deal with weed pressures and mm-hmm. a much more
and crazy corn hybrids that can.
Right. And yeah. So through genetic engineering and the agrochemical side of things and the equipment modifications and precision ag practices, we probably are making more money per acre, no doubt. Not even probably, no doubt. We're making more money per acre, but probably not that much more if you were to pool all the money adjusted for inflation rates, that all those small farms collectively together would have in a cash conversion sense had been generating. And when you had that many farmers, you had that many more tractor owners, you had that many more fence buyers, you had that many more barn builders, that many more. And so these small communities didn't just have coal mines and farms. They had, you know, for lack of a better term, the supply outlets to keep those small farms supplied and functioning. You know, I was listening to a podcast the other day where a guy had to call a vet while he was going through calving that lives about 30, 35 miles away from where he had his operation. And it's like that, there's no way that was the case back, you know, 60, 70 years ago. So the old model, when people were living close to the utility purpose of why they were living there, there was more industry. it was a lot. You know, you had think of the evidence as far as how farm equipment manufacturers have consolidated.
Definitely. And that's, I was going to mention that, or I was thinking about that as you were talking. Mercer County, who has one John Deere dealership now, I think they used to have like 5 or 6 ag dealerships.
Wow.
So you talk about that support system that existed.
Yeah.
To keep rural America on track of what it was doing at that point. And some of these towns that are ghost towns now, besides whatever people are left, had JCPenney's, Sears.
Yeah.
I mean, they had railways coming into them.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, another interesting piece of it is that I bet there's the same amount of money in John Deere dealerships in Mercer County as there used to be, but it all has to pool into one. The reason being, the cost of 8 tractors back then is the cost of half a tractor today. So basically whoever could sell 6 tractors was going to survive and everybody else was going to die out. But then at the same time, there's way more energy put into building each tractor. So it's almost like the people don't make the money on the farming side of the tractor. They make the money on the building side or the engineering side. Right. So it's like which side. But then that comes to a big issue that we've come to is, okay, economically things are evening out, right? Might even be better, but people are way less connected to the land because the jobs aren't on the side of connecting that tractor with the land. They're on the side of building the tractor. And so if you're not connected to the land and you're just living in rural America and not even farmsteading, just watching TV in there, it's like, well, then move closer to Walmart, you know?
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you also look at the roadblocks to engaging with rural America, like just like the chicken story that we started out with.
Yeah.
And I had sent Kent, I think I sent you a picture of a receipt a while back of what chicken feed costs. And we were not getting along with using corn from the fields as far as being a, it was not nutrient dense enough for the chickens to produce eggs. So I started
There's another buying, can of worms coming up.
Yeah. So I started buying chicken feed. And from the economic standpoint, it does get you thinking then like, okay, this has to be beneficial in some way for me to do it. Otherwise, yeah. I'm stupid.
Oh, because it's so expensive?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, I don't have a cost of a dozen eggs right now in front of me calculated. I probably don't want to know what that is.
Yeah.
And again, I do think that there are enough benefits because those chickens are free range and they're being supplemented with this. And this was also in the winter months. So I can't be completely negative, both in the literal sense and the figurative sense on that. But it is something that you start considering, okay. And I mean, Ken and I have talked about like hunting before and that's a pretty good parallel as far as what's as a T chart of pros and cons go with this. You hope that your pros are outweighing your cons and that you're not just doing something completely for nostalgia's sake.
Right.
And hunting. Yeah. I want to press on you on that one, Kent.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, I did not prep Kent on this. So we'll see. Something you mentioned about hunting is putting food on the table for your family. And usually that's not like your main point, but that's like a little side point. But, and I'm not against hunting. You know that if you want to hunt, I believe you should be able to hunt. But like that doesn't make sense because the effort going into hunting, even if it's not just economic, it's probably cheaper per pound. But then, eventually,
when you're first starting out, as my buddy Noel likes to say, game meat is the most expensive meat on the planet.
Well, yeah, because you're buying all that equipment. Right. And yeah. And so in terms, I'm just talking about economically, like it's just not the best way to put food on the table for your family. Why do you say that? Why do you bring it up that way?
Well, so another point Fritch had on his list was malnourished food. I think that was a term we came up with the other day when we were talking about, was it chicken eggs or something?
Yes.
And That is a real problem. Malnourished food.
Yeah.
We do not have chickens. My wife really wants to get chickens, but we have too many of our own little chickens that we're raising right now that we need to go out and help with the chores. And, yeah. And, so we will for sure have chickens, soon, but we need to be able to get some more help from the kids first. And, you know, but we do a garden and I hunt a lot. And, I think hunting serves a couple, you know, many different purposes. So, my doe that I shot this year with my bow, that came off of, our home farm, and Fritz knows the exact location is, right next to, the Rock Island rail line, old railroad trestle built right before or during the Civil War. And, I shot that doe a couple hundred yards from my house. And so that would be an example of, you know, I actually got the bow for free. I won it at an event. And, you know, the arrows had some cost. Of course, the clothing I was wearing had some cost at some point, but you know, I've gotten many years of use out of this stuff. And so that was probably economically, yes, that was probably pretty cheap, Nicholas. Nutritionally, if I had replaced that, venison, which is not as organic as we like to claim that it is. It's eating a lot of the same things that a feeder lot cow is eating. You know,
I mean, just because it's going out in the field and snagging that corn.
Right. Yeah. But deer also, they have a good reputation of having a very diverse diet.
Yeah, they browse,
They're browsers, so they eat a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and they don't stay in one spot for long. You know, they're constantly, if you ever watch deer, they don't just stand in one spot like a cow and graze. They take a little nibble, then they walk on, take a little nibble, then walk on. They're not, you know, just static. The only time they're static is when they're chewing their cud or bedded down.
They walked right on and then 100 years later. Or when they're
crossing the road
there.
Right in front of you while you're driving at like, you know, 10 PM. They like funny. To stand still then. But so they get their meat from being a free ranging animal that's browsing on all this different nutritional value on the landscape. The amount of nutrition in that meat is more than most commercially available protein sources.
If I went to Africa right now and got eaten by a lion, that lion would have to also deal with malnutrition. All the garbage that I
got clogged my arteries.
Be moving slow the next day.
you know what should it? So I don't think I've said this on the podcast. I deal with eczema that flares up, and I've been spending years trying to figure out when it flares up. Maybe in college I realized it was after certain foods, but I can't figure out what it is. And my only guess left is because it'll randomly flare up, sometimes with eggs, sometimes not with eggs, sometimes with gluten, sometimes not with gluten. And there was another one that, and my only guess is like some sort of pesticide or chemical or like, antibiotic or like growth hormone that they use that's my only guess because it's not a specific food. I've even paid attention to what state it ships out of. It's not consistent on geographic location. And so, and it'll be within moments, like less than 60 seconds. I'll eat something and I'll feel it. There's a couple spots in my hands that flare up. They get these little bubbles on them. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and so, yeah, what you're revealing there is another part of this process. You hear people talk about know where your food comes from. And I used to kind of like shrug that off years ago. But the older I get, the more I understand the value of that.
It all comes from Cargill. All of it.
Well, you know, another good phrase is you are what you eat. And there's a lot of, I mean, it's very much oversimplified, but there's a lot of truth to that.
Kent, you and I would just be Oreo fluff.
There's a large part of my DNA that
that is just a Oreo.
But no, I mean, so I'm getting that value from it. But also, like when I this year I went and harvested a deer out in western Nebraska. Nothing efficient about that deer meat. But what that does, what that side of hunting provides me, is a reason to interact with a new landscape, which is important to me as a conservationist and as an outdoors person. I want something inside me still exists that existed in 10 generations of my family ago. The desire to see what's over that hill over there. You know, that's very, I think it's some people that that feeling is pretty much gone. People like myself and Fritch, that is very strong. We want to see what does the land have to offer over there. And that's helped guide human migration through the ages. But so exercising that is still part, is still something that hunting provides me. But mainly it's the nutrition value that it gives my family. So yes, it's not as efficient as just going to the grocery store and spending 30 minutes there and checking out and everything. And then, you know, it's home in the, you know, it, it takes many hours. Not, you know, it's not just like, oh, I'm going to go hunting today, so I'll have a deer, you know, when I come back. Mm-hmm. Especially bow hunting, you know, you it can take dozens of nights out hunting or mornings out hunting before you get a shot opportunity.
Yeah.
And then I like to process the deer myself at home. And so now you have many more hours involved into that process. But going back to what Fritch said, well, what's the alternative? So what do I do with that? So it's more efficient, right? So what am I going to do with that time that's truly more valuable? Yeah, maybe I could go get a second job because now I get my meat from the store instead of the tree stand. But what is most likely going to be the thing that I end up doing? Mm-hmm. Whole lot of thumb scrolling, whole lot of, you know, slack jaw TV watching, right?
Yeah.
And so it, in, I think probably the most important thing it does for me is it engages me with the area that I live. I wanted to move where I moved because I wanted to live where I hunt. I mean, and that kind of goes back to something I harp on my other podcast that I host, is people always want to call hunting a hobby. And I think for some folks, it probably is just a hobby. But for myself and many others that I know, it is much more a lifestyle. And I would say that, you know, people would roll their eyes at that and say, I'm making an excuse for just going out and hunting more than I should. And maybe I am. But when you move somewhere so you can live where you hunt, I'd say that that pretty much defines a lifestyle built around that way that I acquire food. And, it goes directly back to where Fritch started this conversation with living near the coal mine. I'm just living near the deer herd, and it provides meaning and purpose for my address.
Mm-hmm. Well, so it sounds like what you're saying is that, I heard this really cool phrase the other day. Paying a very high price for something of infinite value is a steal.
Yeah.
So even if you're paying more for that, you just it's just too hard to quantify what you're getting out of it.
Yep.
And one of the things that piles on top of this huge mountain of benefit you get from it is putting food on the table.
Yep.
That's good. I just wanted to pick your brows thinking about that the other day. I was like,
it's a fair question. I think it's a question every hunter should be asked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And I'm not against hunting for sport, you know, either.
Yeah. That's part of it too.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun. Hunting's fun.
Yeah. So we're 50 minutes into this thing, guys, which is like usually where we start asking our last two or three questions. I don't think we're there yet.
No.
But here's
we're still going.
I told Kent this. I want to know. We're in Iowa. My wife goes to every single school meeting in our district or school board meeting in our district. I'm pretty in the know about what's going on in our area, and Kent helps me follow what's going on at the state level. What's going on at schools here, Luke?
Well, about the same thing that's always been going on in them.
Oh, and the reason it matters is because conservation happens one mind at a time. So, you know, where your beginning education starts.
Well, all this stuff ties together. You know, we're talking about societal values, essentially, is what we're doing this whole podcast.
Yeah, and I mean, I just got done referencing our school and our problems with enrollment. And when you look at a rural area, and when Kent refers to like societal values and looking at the history of the public school system, and a lot of people were on the same page when those things were being developed. As far as the rural area goes, a lot of those people had similar mindsets, and not that everybody has to be the same, cut from the same exact cloth in order for this to work. But what I've seen is that we don't seem to agree on anything now, to the point where a parent is sending their child to school and they have no idea why, besides it's because the government requires them to do so, or they don't want to be around that child.
Yeah.
A sad and very truthful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. 8 hours of babysitting.
So there are, as Kent and I have talked and we've dealt with a lot of these kids, there are amazing students out there that are taking full advantage of the system. And that's what redeems it for people like me at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Is
those are the best. Those were the best parts of education when I was in it, was the students that wanted to be there and do well.
What percentage was that?
I would say that maybe it's less than 20.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not saying that all student, the 80% are walking out of there with nothing. I hope that some of them are coming out with some evidence that they were in an academic situation or maybe an opportunity for growth towards a career or whatever that might be. But when you're in that system day in and day out, a lot of times it's tough to see that evidence.
Oh yeah, dude. I couldn't imagine being a teacher. Sounds truly dreadful. And I help with, I was a youth pastor, not the youth pastor, but a youth pastor at church for a while. And that's kids mostly on good behavior, you know, and I was like, ooh, being a teacher would be tough.
Well, to correlate back to what you, kind of where we were at with that as well, you look at rural America now, and as the opportunities have disappeared and the industry has left, and there's no reason to have a farmer every 80 or 160 acres anymore now, when you teach in a rural school district, that clientele changes so much. Because like we were talking about, why is someone inhabiting that property? And it may not always be for the best reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, we have experience with that. Something that I found really interesting in a podcast I was listening to recently was they were talking about Japan and they were comparing it to the United States and they were talking about some of the downfalls of Japan, but they said the one amazing thing that is the reason that Japan is starting to kick everybody's butt economically per capita. I mean, they're a smaller country, so they're never going to like beat out China or something, but every single person, no matter what they did, whether they picked up garbage or they taught students, had deep pride in their work. Everyone had uniforms for where they worked. They kept their uniforms clean. Teachers wore suits. You know, students were super proud of where they were able to go to school. And there was just deep pride in there. And there was no looking down on laymen. There was it wasn't just blue collar people being proud of their blue collar. It was white collar people having high respect for the blue collar, the blue collar jobs. And I'm not saying that that's like totally lacked, but I don't know. I wasn't around 60 years ago, but from movies and the way people talk about it, you know, being a plumber was a very respectable thing and everyone appreciated the plumber. And now it's kind of like, you know, but I think we're coming back to the trades and having more respect for the trades again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and just what you said there is so key. We've talked about that before in this podcast, is taking pride in one's work. If you want to see a good employee, it's going to be somebody who's doing that, who's taking pride in their work. And I think somehow through time, and maybe even with good intentions, probably misguided, but good intentions. We've taken away those incentives for taking pride in one's work and have rewarded a system of someone's going to pick up the slack downstream or probably good enough. And that compounds as it moves along the chain of whatever. So in education, if it starts at the home level, good enough. It goes to school, and when a student's doing their work, good enough. And the teacher grades on a curve, good enough. And when the job force comes looking, or the college goes to accepting applicants, good enough. You've had this compounded, you know,
exponential decay.
Yes, exponential decay. The entropy, right, of the system is just slowly unraveling a little more as it goes on. And, you know, I've often thought, if you're in a spot where you know expectations are extremely flexible, like, there's comfort in that for sure, right? I've been in systems like that where there's like not a real, there's no like hard, how do I say this? Hard ending point that you have to worry about. Like,
accountability,
right? Yeah. There's no hard accountability at the end of the road. Then, you know, you're probably in a system that is functioning with exponential decay, because the people that are supposed to have a expectation for you don't. And that's comfortable, but it's not good. And so then you're going to not have an expectation for yourself.
Mm-hmm. I think this fits well with you guys. I've many friends who are youth pastors, and I was talking to one of them, and they were trying to talk about dating and stuff like that with the kids, and they let the kids write in anonymously what they, and one of them said, some seventh grade kid, I don't know who it was, said, how can I get girls to sleep with me? Right. And he was like really upset. And I was telling him, I was like, brother, you are not looking at your own failing. You are looking at a parent's failing. And while you're doing the best you can, youth pastors will never be parents. And it's the same, like, these teachers come in, they're like, look at all these students, like, that aren't, you know, that they're not getting anything. And it's like, well, yeah, but you didn't. I mean, there are many teachers who have failed students. But
absolutely.
You know, if a teacher's trying their best and they're trying to connect, more often than not, it's like a parent failed a student somewhere, and then they want to blame the teacher for not failing their kid forward so that they can play in the next basketball game. And
yeah, it is very tough, if not impossible, to undo 16 years of conditioning in a semester.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Dude. Yeah. Or like convincing, and it can be pretty inappropriate. It's like not your place to convince a student like, hey, actually, you're worthy of love. I know your parents taught you by neglecting you for 14 years that you're not worthy of being loved and appreciated, and I can't teach you that in the next 9 months. You know, and even us getting that close wouldn't be appropriate. Mm-hmm. But you know, and that's one of many things that a kid can learn that could potentially ruin their education career.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's also important to acknowledge that a lot of these problems are not new problems. You know, this has been, my own grandmother came from an extremely adverse upbringing. And it's tragically sad to reflect on that, but it's also good medicine to realize this is not, I think they say this in Ecclesiastes, right? This is not something new under the sun.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, these problems, although it's been experiencing exponential decay, and so I think they are getting more acute as time goes on, they've been around for a long time. And so it's not just the failings of our current generations that are, you know, calling shots. But the purpose of this podcast is to, well, is a lot of things, right? Sometimes, like this episode, it's to point out the problem. Hey, that's a problem. But we also have the opportunity, since it's our turn now. I was thinking of this a little bit when we were talking with Chase Burns, Nicholas, when he talked about how the history of his farm was, it was a hog pasture, mm-hmm. and all the regen acorns. So all the next generations of acorns that were being dropped by the oak trees that existed 60 years ago were getting gobbled up by hogs, you know? So there were, there, you had these really old oaks and no young oaks coming back up the ranks, and how the herdsman that was doing that was not doing anything wrong. Certainly probably did not consider the consequences of what that might mean. And the effects of that are now felt now for Chase, who wants to have a lot of oak trees on his farm, right? Mm-hmm. But what has Chase done? He's gone and bought a whole bunch of oak trees and started to plant them there. And that's really what our, we can't control what happened 60 years ago, but we can look at now and say, okay, this, those things are going pretty good. Let's keep those things. Let's support them. Let's bolster them. But these things over here either make zero sense, are killing us, or are ruining everything else. Let's get rid of those things and replace them with something good and bolster it up and fix it. You know, and I think that that's what we're trying to do, you know, yeah. when we mm-hmm. when we talk about this stuff. Another, so we've let's look at our list here of what we've covered so far. We covered living in rural America, hunting versus growing versus buying. We've talked about that.
Talk about classrooms now.
yeah. Classrooms, malnutrition or malnourished food. But we need to talk a little bit about farming specifically. We've been referencing all throughout, I think. But there's some ag census stats that you find interesting. If nothing else,
yeah.
If not alarming, right? Let's start with the age of the average farmer right now.
Do you remember what that was?
58 was it?
I think it was around that. I don't remember specifics on this, and I mean, obviously that stuff's available for listeners.
Yeah.
So we don't need to, or I don't need to. Miscite numbers here,
but it was like the one I remember was the age of landowners.
That was higher. That I think that yeah. was 67, wasn't it?
Well, it was 2/3 of all landowners were above the age of 65 or something like that.
Yeah,
yeah. So operators have gotten, the average age of an operator has skyrocketed.
Yeah.
The average age of a landowner has skyrocketed, and it's funny because you were talking about those oaks, and it's like, there's your analogy right there.
Yeah.
Is you're sitting in a pasture and it was all old oaks and there was enough shade, who cares? Well, what about when they aren't there anymore?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, looking at those stats, and I don't think there was any maliciousness in how those were released.
No, yeah. It just seemed like a matter of fact.
When we talk about like the Norman Rockwell ideal that they want to push on people when it comes to agriculture, I don't think that the way that them stats were put out there were really in that same lens where it's like, hey, let's fool the public
yeah.
and make them think that all these subsidies are going to the right place and whatever else. Although I do think that happens from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the first things that they talked about in the report that I read, or actually listen to on the radio as well, but it's like the average size of a farm is 370 acres.
Yeah.
And I thought, huh. And I think they said it decreased. And we talked about this, I think, the last time. And that was in the idea of, okay, we're averaging something here. So if you add 4 or 5 acre farmers and they are classified as a farmer and filed whatever as far as that income goes.
Oh yeah. Farmer's market, garden farmers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
And you have one person that goes from farming 5,000 acres to 10,000 acres. Those 5-acre farmers are pretty good at canceling out those big numbers.
Right.
When you're sitting there teetering on both sides of that, on those extremes.
Yeah.
And I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, like for a specific example, but, and as far as like our, and some of our intentions with this podcast and rebuilding rural America, it is happening, and slowly it seems like people are getting more interested in returning to the ground and having it, wanting a purpose to be there.
Yeah.
So we do see these small farms popping up where people have chickens or cows or whatever, and they do want to take control of what their family's eating. And like in the case for me, I want to provide certain experiences for my daughters that they would not have had otherwise, in addition to those other things that we've talked about with on the nutrition side.
Mm-hmm.
But that 370 number, I think, is pretty misleading if we're not taking into consideration that it's not a bunch of 370-acre farms. It's a bunch of super small farms, and it's probably a bunch of very large farms.
Yeah.
Without a whole lot in the middle.
So what's the median? Although I could see the median farm also being like 12.
Median farm would be smaller than that average, just because there's less and less big farms now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
those continue to consolidate.
Correct. So, if you have 2 5,000-acre farms, well, that's now 1 10,000-acre farm.
Yeah.
And it's not as simple as that, I know, but for the sake of what we're talking about.
Yeah, for illustrated point.
So, yeah, I do think that median...
Calculus teacher, everybody.
Yeah. I do think that median would be much smaller just because you have such a large percentage, a large quantity of farms that are in that band. And that being said, I think I sent this maybe to Kent. It's like 54% of the farms. I said I wasn't going to cite specifics, but it's over half of the farms account for around 1% of the sales.
Hmm.
Less than half of the farms account for 99% of the sales.
Correct.
That's crazy.
That's coming from that top end of the range.
I think it ended up being 14% of the farms account for 80% of the sales.
Wow. So the like gross income off of produce growth.
Correct. So that gives you a little bit more of an idea of what the distribution's like on that data. And in that 14%, there's still what I would consider relatively small farms included in that, just because that cutoff was such a small number that as you get in, if you actually get into that band of where that those 80% of sales are, you would end up seeing not very many farms accounting for maybe 95% of that 80%.
Hmm. Yeah. So here's the data that you pulled out of there. This is from the morningagclips.com 2022 Census of Agriculture update status of Illinois ag. The top 14% of farms, which is greater than 500 acres, accounted for 80% of sales. The bottom 54% shared 1% of sales. So those tiny farms that are pulling down that average farm size, which we're thankful for those small farms. It's great.
Definitely.
It's people doing, living with purpose and wanting to have a part of farming. They are only though accounting for 1% of the sales coming from productive acres in Illinois.
You know what's interesting is the shift of the word farmer going from being like connected to livestock and land intimately to like heavy machine operator. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because like heavy machine operators, they get paid very well, but they go through high intense training to be HMO. And you know, farmers today, that's what they do. They deal with heavy machinery, and they work on them some. I mean, for the most part, they're not going to be tinkering with the computers, but you know, they'll change out discs and stuff like that on their machinery. But then, and this isn't even like, can you believe it? All they are HMOs, but like it's just fascinating to me, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad that you said that, because that's something that Kent and I have actually talked about before. And I was kind of embarrassed because I grew up on a farm and I knew no biology or agronomy.
Hmm.
So I was so immersed in the equipment age, as a lot of farmers' sons are.
Yeah.
That it was all about red machinery or blue machinery. And we were so far away from what a farm actually is.
Yeah.
That looking back, it's funny. And you're right. It switched from the people that were stewards of the land and raising livestock and like getting their hands dirty with that stuff, to all of a sudden it was if you're mechanically inclined or if you enjoy operating machinery.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. It's amazing to me as well, to the point where, say, what's the seed depth? I don't know. It's the book said, I think, to put it at 9, whatever that means.
Yeah. So switch the dial to 9.
Yeah.
Not even like inches or anything, just like a dial on the machine.
Right.
And then we like scienced our way out of everything and like Kent was talking about chemical control of weed pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, okay, we're going to have a sterile environment. We're going to have genetically modified seed to the point where we don't have to worry about anything. All we have to do is get in that cab and make sure that this ends up in the ground. It'll take care of the rest.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think that the operators, the farmers, if you had to ask them if they wanted it to come to this, I don't think that they would say yes. But I also think that that question hasn't been posed either. And so
which question?
Like the question that, are you glad that farming is what it is now? That it, where you're divorced from the actual agronomy of what it is you're doing, you know, the horticulture, the whatever you want to call it, you know, the animal husbandry, you know. And to be fair though, I think in the livestock world, there still is a lot of that still exists, especially in cattle operations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sheep operations, anything where you're doing more, you know, in a way free ranging, you know.
Oh,
you're still working with nature.
Non-confinement.
Dealing with livestock is like a different animal. No
right,
pun intended.
Right. And nicely done there.
Not meant to.
But no, but my point is, I say that because I don't want farmers to be demonized from this, because I don't think that it's, I think we're all complicit, right? Like we all demanded more for less. And so the system said, fine, this is what more for less costs and what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, I don't want to look at that. I just want more for less. And the folks that are still caught within the cogs of making that system work, there's not much choice for them. But I also think that they need to be asked if they like it, if they're okay with it, because then that's really where people start to adopt changes. I hear all the time of farmers when they've been, you know, given some choice, they're like, yeah, of course I would choose to do that instead now that I know about it, you know, or now that I've been had this data put in front of me. I've heard people talk about that with like soil health practices, you know, and honestly, when you look at, which I know that can be a controversial subject, but overall, I think we, you know, cover crops are a very good thing. And as you look across the landscape, there's a lot of farm operations that are adopting the use of cover crops. Now, I think there's still a lot of like fine tuning that needs to be done there. And the learning curve is still
slap some cover crops, man, fixed climate change. Fixed.
Yeah. Whoa. You can see green on the field. Better get the sprayer out here. But, you know, I think that'll continue to get better. But my point is, I think that we have to bring these things up and we have to consider them, but we also don't want to demonize farmers for being in a system that, especially at this point, they largely didn't build themselves. They kind of got dragged into. And, but we can make the changes to flip the system. But it's going to take a lot more than just a handful of people doing that. It's going to take a whole movement.
And I think you did a nice job there of even recycling to our first topic, which is just rural America in general. And if you're looking for diversification, you talk about like asking a farmer, is this what you pictured this being? Did you want to be the terminal generation? You're the fifth one. I mean, I start this podcast out by saying I'm a sixth generation farmer, but really that's not 100% accurate because I'm obviously a teacher.
Yeah.
And as far as the line goes in my family, my dad was the last farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And my brothers have been able to buy ground, luckily, because of off-farm jobs.
Yep.
But, and that's, I'm glad for that because they're actually able to be engaged with agriculture through those.
Mm-hmm.
But it really has not been an option with the way the landscape has been for younger people to get involved that much. So, and I guess when I was talking about diversification, what I was thinking about there, and I remember asking my brother this years ago, where we were talking back and forth, and he works for the USDA, and it was very easy for my pedestal to sit here and whine about people not being diversified. And at that time I was working for the neighbor who was baling a lot of hay, and I found a lot of enjoyment in that.
Mm-hmm.
So we were having those conversations about, man, why can't the world still be this way? And then he just brought up, he's like, well, yeah, I agree with you to a certain point, but what about the line of equipment that takes to grow another crop? And he recently got into hay when he bought his farm, and just seeing the stresses involved with that and then turning around and having to market that hay.
Yeah.
He's like, now you know why people grow corn.
Yep.
It's one pass with the planter. You call somebody to have it sprayed, you harvest it and haul it in.
Yep.
How many phone calls are made? Zero.
Yeah.
So there is a fairness into what you said as far as that. We don't think all operators wanted the world to end this way. It just kind of did
also let, he means end up this way. Not like the world's ending.
He said what he said, Nick.
Okay. I'm not going to put words in your mouth. But you know, something that I find really interesting, I've been thinking a lot about, is infrastructure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Amazon and UPS make tons and tons of money off of the infrastructure of highways. Our podcast makes its rounds through the infrastructure of the internet. And the infrastructure of corn and soybean markets is actually a really good thing that took a while. And it's almost like just like in your brain, the more you think about something, the stronger those pathways through neurons are made.
Yeah.
I think the same happened with corn and beans. There were so many corn and beans over and over again through the same metaphoric pathway through the economy that we said, hey, let's make this an interstate. And then everyone around went, why would I take those gravel roads when there's this giant interstate of infrastructure?
That's a very good analogy.
Of corn. Thanks, man. It came to me and I had a whole cup of coffee at 7:30 p.m. like a crazy person. And I wonder, I don't want to take away that infrastructure because I like that it's more efficient for those farmers, but maybe we should put other products on the same pedestal to be able to get the infrastructure. And frankly, I don't know if native seeds should be on that pedestal, because when you're talking a pedestal that large, you're talking about a worldwide market, and native seed is a Midwest, or should be a Midwest region, you know, market. But I feel like there's many other things that really could benefit agriculturally from having those, that larger highway.
And I was talking to a different farmer kind of about similar grievances around the same time. And he is an active farmer, and he got a little bit defensive, but I showed me how much I had to learn. And he pretty much stated in a roundabout way of what you just shown some light on. And that's, okay, if you want people to be growing all these different crops, where are the end users at?
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to grow 80 acres of tomatoes like you're suggesting right now, Fritch. And then, okay, take them to Walmart and have them reject them.
It is a very fair point. And I mean, some of the reason the highway system that Nick, you know, used his metaphor on, which was a good one, simply exists because of stuff like that. Well, we can't all be growing tomatoes because tomatoes go bad really fast. Mm-hmm. You know, what can farmers grow that they can store for a long period of time without it going bad? How about corn and soybeans? So some of what exists is just simple problems like that, and having an end user, and what equipment does it take to efficiently grow tomatoes? Well, if I grew just enough tomatoes for what my family eats in a year, it probably doesn't justify me having a tomato harvesting, attachment on a tractor or something, you know.
A bright side. Oh, sorry. So
there's limitations like that, but I think that also, like, that goes back to the principle of it's not so bad to do hard work, you know, maybe we don't need a tomato harvester because we were born with two of them right here.
Yes. Right?
And maybe, you know, having a local food chain where, our tomato vines gave us way more than we could use this year. Hey, how about we go over to the neighbor and trade him some tomatoes for, you know, something, you know, some extra potatoes that they have, or sell them, or whatever, you know, like that. There was some good that came out of that. And I think stronger communities were a byproduct of that too. So, there's part of it is we just have to say, you know what, maybe it's okay, kind of like the hunting conversation. Maybe it's okay that I'm spending so much time doing this because it's probably good for me in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, there's more value than what's cheapest than the dollar right now.
Right.
I think that's a really, it goes back to our motto, conservation happens one mind at a time, but like change in a food system is going to happen one mind at a time. The bright side is like Matt, what was his name?
Hatala.
Hatala. I keep forgetting that last name. Matt Hatala. What he did is said, okay, I have an issue. I desire a different source for food. I can't be the only one. I almost guarantee you, anyone who's listening to this, if you have an issue with something, someone else has an issue as well. There's a bunch of them. And
someone
you can actually
picking that bone.
Well, and which means there's a market for you.
Right.
But because you're the first one, you're taking a gravel road to this market, but you could be the first step to an interstate. And I only know two prairie companies that were in it before dad One of them is kind of fading out. The other one is going strong. So he's like, there are three people going down that gravel road. And now it's not an interstate, but it's at least a two-lane highway. It's something. And that's okay to do it. But I think that there's a silver lining in that where there are enough people around in the market just that it can be economically viable. It can be. And I don't think, I'm sure there are many lazy farmers, but I don't think the majority of the farmers are lazy. I'm willing to bet the bigger barrier is fear of, can I sell this at the end of the year? Mm-hmm. Cause at the end of the day, you can always bring corn in for a bare minimum of $4 a bushel, you know?
Well, let's be honest. If all of us without being given any money right now, but we were just given 50 acres of tillable land, but no additional funding, what would we probably do for at least the first year on that 50 acres of tillable land?
Rent it out.
Rent it to a corn and bean operation because of the gravel road problem.
Yeah.
Because if we were going to do something different, we would have to somehow come up with the equipment to just farm. I mean, a step in the right direction would just be to farm those to corn and bean those 50 acres ourselves. That's the first baby step in that right direction. To go a step further would be to do, you know, maybe 5 to 10 different species of crops on those 50 acres. That where do you have the time and resources to do all of that, you know? And so it is important. I think you make a very valid point that, you know, you can see how the common denominator continues to be the same common denominator, you know?
Well, now you look at trying to achieve something like that when ground has been sold for $25,000 an acre.
Oh, right. Yeah. Forget about it.
And it's cash renting for, I don't even know what.
I've seen 470. That's the highest I've ever seen. Yeah.
So,
but I think usually like 280 or something.
We are so far down the road on that model now, and going further, as you see more and more land sales come up, and just like you said, if you were handed 50 acres, you don't have an option.
Right.
I mean, maybe you do if you have some amazing source of income and time,
yeah,
and knowledge to make that work. But that would be a very intimidating thing. It's like, oh, okay, Kent.
Yeah.
Plant your chestnut trees and good luck paying
the by the way, you won't have a
this year.
Let alone the water bill
to keep those alive.
If everything goes well, you'll have a crop in 10 years or something.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. So I think it's important, you know, we're probably getting close to talking in circles now. It's getting late, but,
I'm so tired,
but, you know, I think all of this is so important to bring all this up, to bring up the realities of what's going on around us. And, you know, not just from a fault finding perspective, although sometimes it's good to have that perspective too, because that helps us identify our blind spots and our problems. But there's some solutions too. Start small, right? Make your change in a small area. So if you were given the 50 acres, you're probably not going to be able to radically convert those 50 acres without some incredible resource financing that. But you could probably convert one of those acres,
or you could. A good point.
Or you could you know, CRP half of it. There's other options. There's other options available.
Yeah.
That we start with, you know, you start with one step at a time, and as that continues to build, as Nicholas said, as the infrastructure continues to grow, which it will, if we get enough people doing this, it will be there. Those positive changes can eventually be in place so that all 50 of those acres can be utilized as they should be, as is best practice. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's where we go back to what Carol tells me. You got to be an optimist. And it's so true. We got to look at what can the positives be, and we got to hold on to them and keep praying for more coming in the future.
I really like that starting small. Like, conservation starts small. Change starts small. So if you get 50 acres, just make a 1,000-square-foot garden. If you can't handle a garden, have 3 pepper plants outside, right outside your door, right there where you'd normally keep some flowers. You keep them right there, and you pluck 8 peppers off of them this year. You're gonna go inside, you're gonna eat them, and you're gonna freaking love it. You know, you can't grow prairie, you don't have the time, but you know where a prairie patch is. Spend the 2 hours once in the fall hand collecting some stuff, and I mean, heck, give us a call, we'll buy that stuff off of you. So, you know, it's that those smaller starts that I think really, and that gives you a chance to figure out that you actually love it, because most people like plants when they get out there and they touch them. You know?
Yep. That's true. That's true. Well, thanks so much, Fritch, for coming back again.
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity.
I'm sure the world.
Kent and I are sharing a twin mattress tonight and far away from our wives. I'm not looking forward to it. People, pray for me, please.
Conservation happens one bed at a time.
I think you better end it on that one.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Just thank you so much, guys. If you're still tuning into this one, thank you for listening to our ramblings as we wax poetic going into the midnight oil supply. It was just a real treat to have Fritch back on the show and hearing his insight and his way of looking at it from 30,000 feet. And
that was a good time.
I look forward to this episode every year. Can't wait for the next one.
Yeah.
I'm sure the world will deal us more problems to look at.
Yeah.
And maybe next year we'll review COVID protocol and how all that was done.
If it doesn't deal us more, we can always create them.
Yep.
Man.
So
before we go, I want to throw in a couple things. First, thank you to the people who have been reviewing our podcast. We've been getting a bunch of those, and you've just been going straight 5 stars. Thank you. If you have a 4-star or lower,
put it on this one.
Well, here's the deal. If you put them on the podcast, it won't change what we do. But what you could do instead is email us and then just leave a 5-star review. but that, and then also sharing the podcast, that's a big deal. But something that Kent and I have been working on this past couple years, and we're starting to get more infrastructure, I guess that's a word for today, is hand collected species. You want to be outside and you know some good places to hand pick some species, give us a call. We'd love to have a conversation, and I'll be really frank with you. I'll tell you what we really want to buy and what we don't want to buy, and give you, I give minimum prices right at the beginning. The reason I'm bringing this up is because I know a ton of people who listen to this podcast love prairie, and if you want to make a little money off it, you can. But this all goes back to our presenting sponsor, Hawks and Native Seeds, who pays our bills and allowed us to have this platform. So shout out to Dad. Don't forget, conservation happens one mind at a time.